Thus we must assume that a planet is a consciously obeying organism, that it is fulfilling law, that law is being released through it. Perhaps we would rather like to think of the planet as an unconscious obeying element or pattern, that like a flower, it is merely fulfilling its natural destiny. But we have no way of knowing that the flower does not have an intelligence. It is only that it does not parallel or come within the experience of our minds. Investigations in India have shown that plants can experience fear even in physical terms. Therefore, our idealist ancestors, who are not desperately trying to kill everything in space as the basis of scientific exactitude, were quite willing to assume that planets were beings, that these beings, like the human body, sustained an infinite diversity of life permeating them and upon their surface, that these forms of life are all provided for by energies released from the earth, and that this balance of energy is maintained by bringing the living things upon a planet into a harmonious balance between earth energy and solar energy. That in the development of creatures, therefore, the great Mother Earth was a fertile area for production. And from this fertility, the seeds in the consciousness of the earth principle were released. And as the earth entity came into embodiment in the planet, it released also into embodiment all the seminal lives which it carried with it from previous embodiment. If the earth can be regarded as some kind of an intelligent organism, then we can see how earth processes, when allowed to fulfill themselves in an orderly manner, may be regarded as adequate. That just as surely as man disobeys the rules of nature, which in this case would be the earth-planet factor, he becomes confused and sick. That the earth, therefore, has its own way of revealing or administering the laws which are part of the universe itself. Planets, in a way, are embryo suns. Other forms are developing in space, which will gradually become great centers of solar power. And the suns, in turn, must be regarded as intelligent or intellectually moved or dominated in some way. The planet is a center for the dissemination of intelligence. The sun is a greater center for the dissemination of intelligence. All of the great central focal points, even beyond the vast categories of constellations and the Milky Way, are immense areas for the release of intellectual or intelligible power. The Greeks preferred to think of the solar power as intelligible. Actually, this intellect, this mind, this thought consciousness power is inherent within the radiance of suns. And this radiance, in turn, permeating planets, is reinterpreted through the planet as the wisdom of the elder is reinterpreted in the education of the child. Therefore, planets are children to the parent sun, which acts not only as parent, but as teacher. continually radiating energy with indwelling intelligence, by means of which energy, by the way, naturally resists the misuse of itself. While it is not always able to prevent abuse, energy itself fights against abuse, providing every possible means of right usage, and immediately punishing abuse with some form of a disaster. The next point that we have to bear in mind, perhaps, is that from all these various centers of consciousness, light, life, power, force, energy, are moving. And that these are all interchangeable terms signifying the same principle in different levels of manifestation. Therefore, in every level of manifestation, intellect is present, but specialized in different ways. In every level of manifestation, consciousness is present, but is differentiated variously. In those forms of life which are not yet capable of maintaining an organized consciousness, we find this conscious principle working apparently upon and through form by means of instinct. Various minute microorganisms fulfill the laws of their being, although we can find no evidence in them of any central nervous system or any mental structure. We know, for example, that creatures without any vestige of a brain, so far as we can discover, are capable of at least rudimentary mentation. That these creatures that have no brain, no way, as far as we can tell, of knowing anything, no sensory perceptions by our standard, can still become aware of food and will draw themselves or move themselves relentlessly towards this supply, and will in many instances show extraordinary skill in the capturing of the necessities of life. Thus, that which has not any eyes can apparently be aware of food. That which has no mind can scheme a way to get it. We have to have only one answer to this, that the mind and these sensory perceptions are there, but on a different level from ours. And if the level is different, there is no need for the clumsy process of building brain the way that we do. This is a peculiar process necessary to our own species, but in no manner demonstrating the ultimate of the intellectual release. Laws also follow in the line of consciousness, and through planets and suns, laws are released by light itself. This, perhaps, is the explanation of the great Buddhist deity, the Virocana Buddha. This, or Dainichi Myori, is the great cosmic abstraction. It is the ultimate conceivable form of a rational being, beyond which we can imagine only the darkness of unconditioned space. Dainichi is the last conceivable shadow, the immensity which cannot be further increased without becoming unintelligible. This great cosmic power is the supporter and sustainer of all things through itself. And the manifestations of every conceivable level of existence are sustained by the energy, the great sun or solar energy, the cosmic solar energy of Dainichi Myori. The being, obviously, is hypothetical, symbolical, metaphysical. But the principle for which it stands has strong scientific possibilities. For it simply means that somewhere in the infinitudes of space is the master pattern from which universal and cosmic systems evolve, within each in its turn lesser systems, until we proceed downward from the greatest imaginable cosmic organism to the least conceivable cosmic organism, only hypothetically knowable even in the presence of the most powerful electronic microscope. We have then the infinitely great and the infinitely small bound together, all being expression of one process. This one process having as its root and substance cosmic consciousness. Just how we shall define this cosmic consciousness is also a little troublesome. A number of years ago, we had quite of an epidemic of it among metaphysicians. Nearly all anyone could have cosmic consciousness in three easy lessons. There seems to have been a little shortage of the complete result, but everyone was hopeful. Actually, cosmic consciousness is something that we cannot rationally conceive. If we can achieve to it at all, it can only be by a direct experience of consciousness, which might be termed a mystical experience. But this mystical experience available to man could only be one of the lesser reflections of the great pattern itself. Cosmic consciousness cannot be directly experienced. It can only be symbolically experienced through the contemplation of the cosmos. In other words, if there is anywhere a form capable of bringing the cosmic consciousness within the conception of man, that form is the cosmos. This is the great mandala. This is the universal symbol by which man may sense but not understand the measure of the universal consciousness itself. Man may recognize aspects of it, but he cannot possibly experience the totality of that experience which projects worlds into existence. Science is divided, philosophy has been divided at times, as to the nature of this consciousness. Some skeptics have said, are we simply fooling ourselves? Is this so-called cosmic consciousness merely a term that we have invented to explain a mechanism that we cannot understand? The question to them, of course, is, does the universe require this basic consciousness? Does it require anything except a perpetual motion machine, an instrumentality which can propagate itself forever without any need for a sovereign intellect? This is a persuasive argument, inasmuch as it also makes further thinking on the subject unnecessary, and very few people want to think if they can possibly avoid it. But actually, it does not solve very much. Cosmic consciousness is a necessity for one reason only, that man is conscious. If there is not some kind of consciousness superior to man, where did his come from? And this offers no solution to the scientific riddle. If the scientist wishes to say that consciousness in man is simply the product of the evolution process, in which he is gradually building instruments capable of producing consciousness, which does not exist until the instrument is available, then the scientist must settle down to try to figure out how many more conscious manifestations have preceded man, and consequently how much superior material is available for the production of consciousness than is found in the constitution of man. If evolution has been forever, in other words, consciousness must have arisen before man, or it could not have arisen in man, just as surely as it must arise in man if it is to arise later in some other form of life. So consciousness, being something we possess, puts us in the same dilemma as the architect who stood looking at the Pyramid of Giza. He shook his head sadly and said, "If I hadn't seen it, I would deny its existence. It's just not possible." But having seen it, the architect was on the horns of a dilemma. He could not deny it. This is much the developing position of science. It is no longer possible to categorically deny consciousness unless we wish to affirm that we have a consciousness ourselves capable of denying it in something else, and to assume that we are the only creature in the infinitudes of time which have produced the endless pageantry of the cosmos, that man and man alone has reached the degree by which he can be aware of his own existence. This is a little too arrogant even for the average scientist to contemplate. He is forced to reorganize his thinking. But if we will assume for a moment that this consciousness in things arises from a consciousness in all things, then we can also realize that from this consciousness arose what Pythagoras called the law of mathematical sequences. In other words, a consciousness is necessary to produce patterns which can only be evaluated in terms of consciousness. If a pattern is obviously the production of consciousness, can only be discovered by the extension or education of consciousness, then we are dealing with a factor which is difficult to depreciate. We are confronted with the simple inevitable that consciousness itself must be at the root of all these conscious processes. Processes which have within themselves a sense of a live value, mathematics, for example, which with all its phases and all its departments must be regarded as something so profoundly intricate that it could only have been produced by an intellect superior to itself. Man has not even begun to explore the profundities of mathematics. And we cannot say that geometry has evolved by merely tossing together a series of unrelated accidents. Mathematics alone demonstrates the absolute order of existence. And mathematical procedures and processes and instruments used as we have used them in atomic research to carry on beyond the power of the human mind, so that we have to depend entirely upon formulas which operate, although they cannot be interpreted in terms of human experience. We have to assume that man in the next 100 years or the next 500 years will penetrate still further into the mystery of mathematics. To do this, he must use his conscious faculties. And he can gain his own knowledge only by the increase of these faculties. We must come to the conclusion then that any problem which consciousness alone can solve, and which solved proves to be an absolutely orderly procedure, that such a process can come into existence itself only by consciousness. There is no other way in which it can come into existence. So we are using consciousness, in a sense, our own consciousness, as a net to capture universal consciousness. If we could capture universal consciousness with plain stubbornness, we would use that. If we could convince ourselves beyond all doubt that there were no universal processes, we would also follow that as a line of least resistance. If we could conquer universal procedure with our appetites, our emotions, or our sensations, we would use those. But we cannot. The only way that we can investigate the universe around us is through the use of the highest faculty that we possess, the conscious mind. The answer has to be that the thing which we are investigating was the production of a mind no less than that which is required to discover it on our part. So cosmic consciousness is more or less justified irrationally by the evidence which arises from its own existence. In mysticism, man himself has always sought to some way penetrate the purposes of deity. He has always desired to know the will of God. Religions have been created on the basis that they were revelations to sages, saints, patriarchs, prophets, by which the will of deity was made known. Nearly all of these so-called religious revelations have been moral systems. Moral systems being based upon the great primary experience of living things, the experience of the consequences of coming into conflict with natural law. Thus, what these religions actually tell us is the rule of the game by which we have to live. The reason for the rule, it cannot give us. And where the rule originated, it can only arbitrarily declare that these rules originated in the mind of God. Actually, cosmic consciousness, as sensed in India, particularly in the yogic schools, was not merely a central consciousness, not merely the mind of a being somewhere in space. Cosmic consciousness was an enveloping immediate value. Cosmic consciousness is in every atom. The true and full consciousness of the universal purpose is closer to us than ourselves at all times. The only difficulty is that we are unable to tune into it or to adjust our own finite faculties as we might adjust an aerial on a television to pick up certain stations. What we are trying to do is tune in cosmic consciousness. But when we attempt this, we always seem to tune in something else. Actually, we are tuning in merely conditions of it. But the full and total experience of it is beyond us because we lack the faculties with which to estimate that which is utterly transcendent. In the Buddhist philosophy, of course, we have the same essential problem. For cosmic consciousness, in this case, is substituted the principle, consciousness, or energy of the Virakana Buddha. All things live by virtue of this cosmic power in perpetual meditation. Functioning from the Dharma Rupa, or body of the law. This consciousness of the Virakana Buddha remains forever in the contemplation of the infinite purpose, remaining, so to say, eternally introverted, in a state of absorption in nirvana or samadhi, universal consciousness knowing. The idea in this system, of course, the esoteric Buddhism of the Shingon and the Tantra, is that the individual, the human being, seeking to achieve cosmic consciousness by some methodology, comes the nearest to it by the realization that pure consciousness is that which is separate from and entirely different from any type of consciousness that we know. Pure consciousness, then must be experienced only when all conditioned consciousness is suspended. Those persons attempting to suspend conditioned consciousness either go to sleep or become obsessed by the psyche in their own subconscious. When the individual doesn't try to be anything, he is unfortunately only himself, and this does not serve the purpose. When the individual does not try to be good, he simply succeeds in not being good, that's all. Nothing is clarified, because the individual's subconscious, upon which he must depend for quietude, is too toxic to permit quietude to arise. All he gets is negation, not quietude. Theoretically, however, if the individual is able to actually escape from all the conditions which personal consciousness impose upon him, he can achieve pure insight. And this pure insight is the nearest that can come to man of the consciousness of the meditating Dainichi Nyori. It is the highest type of samadhi. It is the achievement of the experience of the all-conscious apart from all conditioned consciousness. But of course, most of all, it is this unconditioned, ever capable of being conditioned by the rising of the will within the meditating deity. In other words, this deity, Dainichi, can at any time cause any kind of consciousness to arise, because total consciousness can release from itself, according to will and yoga, that which is required. The individual, however, has no such immediate capacity, but he is capable of sensing a kind of all consciousness that is not particularly conscious of one thing. The mystic, in his illuminations and in his visions and in his ecstasies, usually experiences universal consciousness merely as a tremendous internal exhilaration. It is sudden release. It is the emergence of the individual from some dark and heavy region into an airy and wonderful realm of light and peace and beauty and happiness. In this experience, the mystic has the inward sense of all-knowing. But this sense is expressed only in the experience of God-loving. It would seem to the being in the mystical experience that he could play a piano or a violin if he had never touched the instruments before. He would have the power to play them within himself. But if he wanted to play the physical instruments, he would have to learn as the same way anyone else would have to learn. Cosmic consciousness does not skill the body. Rather, it becomes an ornament and a vital moving force for the body which has already skilled itself. There is no substitute for the struggle to gain mastery of body, emotion, and thought. But in this experience of cosmic consciousness, the individual has the sense, a strange, perhaps impossible, over-recognition of the unities of life, of the tremendous realities of things, antagonisms, separatenesses of all kinds fade away. There remains only the sense of the profound accord between all of the parts of life, the experience of being one with the universal consciousness itself. And this universal experience is as though consciousness was a great sea or ocean permeating all things. And in Buddhism, the individual attains this in the mantra as the dewdrop falls back into the shining sea. The individual becomes one again with the eternal. This type of consciousness, if man can even sense it, suddenly unfolds for him the entire pattern of the universe. He realizes that the essential universe is consciousness, that all of the appearances and forms that we see are merely, as Plotinus calls them, the effulgent blossoms suspended from the divine nature. That everything actually is a mystery in consciousness, forever moving towards the destinies which lie hidden within its own depths. Man, sensing something of this, then is able to understand, at least in a measure, how all laws, all principles, all processes can be within consciousness. That just as surely as every physical substance necessary for the creation of worlds must be in what we are likely to call empty space, so every spiritual need must be met and sustained and supported from the more abstract spiritual kind of vacuum which materialists assume to be all that extends beyond matter. We have to assume, therefore, that this invisible, intangible thing which we call spirit or consciousness, is absolutely the source of all tangible, manifested existences. That in it is not only consciousness, but the root of all substances. That just as surely as this vast sea of consciousness extends invisibly, within the bottom somewhere hidden in this sea are rocks and mountains and stones. Everything that exists has to come into manifestation from this thing which seems to be empty. Also, from this same process must flow out all of the laws which are like the currents of an ocean. Currents by means of which all of the processes of creation are carried out. The wise men follow the currents and are carried by these currents in their little ships to safe harbors. Those who try too hard to steer themselves in unknown seas often end on the rocks. But whatever be the procedure or analogy we wish to use, we have to sense that all the laws likewise emerge from these basic processes. Now, one more law that we can perhaps give a thought to at this time is the great law of evolutionary process. Evolution is the impulse behind the ideation or release of the potentials of processes of growth. Evolution, therefore, actually is a motion of a thing toward its ultimate, toward that which is forever next. And in this case, the next must always be better than that which precedes it. Evolution is then the unfolding of life. But evolution is also the reuniting of consciousness. Just as surely as growth seems to unfold the beauty of the individual part, as several flowers magnificently evolving their blossoms, so growth likewise is the process of bringing the consciousness of these forms back into a state of unity. Therefore, all evolution is toward unity. All evolution is toward the rescuing of existences from the illusion of separateness resulting from inadequate power of inward discernment or discrimination. Evolution is the release and improvements of those faculties by which the identity of life can be comprehended. The instruments by means of which evolution is advanced are the two doctrines of rebirth and karma. Rebirth applies not only to man, but to planets, to suns, to every type of life. Because rebirth is simply a law of cyclic process. All forms, due to the fact that they are artificial compounds, they are space itself or consciousness itself curdled into a temporary organism. This temporary organism is not the true and proper owner of this space from which it fashions an instrument. Therefore, it must come to this instrument and depart from it. During the process of investment with this instrument, the consciousness gains manifestation on some level of manifestation. Having achieved a certain measure of manifestation, it must retire again and build a new instrument. Thus, the doctrine of rebirth applies to suns and cosmic suns and universal systems. For all of these have to ultimately be dissolved and then reintegrated on a higher level. There is an operation working in this also, which we do not fully understand, but which we see a parallel for in human life. Namely, that long living and much experience not only creates an exhaustion of powers, but also results in a confusion in the ability to digest experience. Consequently, a period of mental or emotional rest must also be set up. Otherwise, the person is unable to escape from the crystallization of his own faculties. And in some way, the crystallizations in space produce also this degree in which they imprison or frustrate life. Therefore, the forms must be dissolved and rebuilt. Karma applies likewise to all creatures possessing initiative. Karma is still the guardian and leader of every power or condition which decides or arrives at any conclusion about anything. The deity, if it wills to create, must accept the consequence of creation, which is usually to be absorbed into the creation and die there, at least temporarily, to be resurrected later through the evolution of the creation itself. But wherever there is action arising from determination or from consciousness, there has to be attendant reaction. This is why in the Buddhist philosophy, nirvana is actually the suspension of the impulse of action. Nirvana is the continuing of a causeless state which cannot therefore produce any consequence. In this way, there is a complete suspension of the processes which either build up or tear down by cosmic procedure. Karma is both good and adverse. The greater the degree of consciousness, the greater the virtue of karma. Therefore, the concept of heaven, which is actually the karmic consciousness of a deity which cannot create evil. This is the old philosophical clue. Whereas hell in philosophy is always the creation of a consciousness capable of evil. And consequently, the infinite creates the heavens, and men create their own hells. In karma, this procedure, therefore, follows along and sustains the procedures of existence. All of these move about the principle of equilibrium, which is also established as a pattern in space. For equilibrium is the condition of the pure principle of space itself, within which polarization arises, but the space itself is never unbalanced. Equilibrium, therefore, is the symbol, actually, of eternity. It is the symbol of that which unborn cannot die, unfashioned cannot be destroyed, having no beginning can have no end, and having achieved complete equilibrium within consciousness can never again be embodied in an unbalanced organism. These processes all exist, and these principles all reside in space, together with many more of which we are now unaware. And it would seem that sometime along the way of life, great thinkers and great leaders of knowledge should be exploring the mysteries of the cosmos for the discovery of these great values, these great principles, so that someday we can build upon them a science of human regeneration based upon man's restoring his true insight into his own relationships with the cosmos. If this can be attained, man attains the greatest degree of security that it is possible for him to know. Well, I guess our time is up for this evening, folks, so we hope to see you next week. Thank you.